Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
The Survivor Specialists are back, and today I am joined by authors Joe Dorowski and Kate Dorowski, the authors of Survivor, A Cultural History, coming out shortly here to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Survivor. I got to read this book earlier today. It's awesome. I loved it. And I'm excited to chat with both of you about this. So welcome. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much for having us on. I'm really excited to have the chance to talk Survivor. It's something we love to do.
I was looking I was looking at the other books that you have in here where you've done the cultural history of television, and or, you know, I know you all did Cheers, A Cultural History, and I see there's a lot of other authors in here. This, if I'm not mistaken, is your first actual dive, though, into a reality TV show, no?
Yeah, for the cultural history of television, this was the first reality TV show that was going to be part of the series. So that's a series from Roman and Littlefield, where they're trying to cover in a somewhat academic but also accessible to any fan, you know, of the series, some of the most iconic TV series that have ever been made. And previously, we had done, as you noted, books on Cheers and Frasier, and then we were looking around for what we wanted to dedicate a couple of years of our life to, both rewatching and reading so many articles about and digging in. And we thought Survivor was definitely going to be something that could warrant a book length study like that. We didn't have a question about that, but we weren't sure if the publisher would want to do a reality TV show. But when we pitched it, it went through pretty quick. I think there was a little, you know, pause of like, is this something we want to do? But then when we stop and think about how impactful Survivor is, and if you're talking about the history of television, to omit Survivor would just be a huge mistake, because it is so significant for how television has changed across the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting, because you're kind of like having to take the same approach with your publisher as Mark Burnett was having to take with CBS, right? Like, nobody wanted Survivor. Nobody wanted Survivor. And then you go down this list, and you, when I look at this, I say, well, Survivor is the one. Like, this is the show. This is what you should be talking about here. So what was it? What is the background on this series then? And how, like, you know, you were kind of chosen for this and all that.
So I watched the first season of Survivor, and then was kind of caught it here and there for the first few years, and then back
Sorry, my internet's struggling. I think I'm
okay.
Oh,
Kate's gonna, Kate's cutting out a little bit. That's okay. So Joe, you keep talking here. I'll shoot Kate a message real quick.
Okay. So then around season 20, my wife and I started watching it live again, you know, as it was coming out, and I went back and rewatched everything that I had missed. And then as part of the process of watching or writing this book, I rewatched the entire series at least twice in full while working on the book. And, you know, sometimes that's like really close. I'm looking at a very specific episode to try and catch, you know, a specific line of dialogue, or it might just be like, this has become a background show that I just kind of have on. So I'm super familiar with it while I'm writing the book. But I definitely remember when that first season came out, I was just getting out of high school when Survivor premiered, and watching this and trying to like understand what is this? Cause it's not something that was familiar to audiences. You know, this idea of a reality TV show competition was pretty new for mainstream audiences to encounter in the year 2000.
And then Kate, I know, I think you're back now. I saw you were frozen for a second.
Yes,
there.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's all good. When did you come into this whole process, and why Survivor? Like, was Survivor, were you a big fan of the show too before you wrote this?
I was. I started watching it. It was definitely like Yule and Aussie seasons. I'm blanking on the name of that.
Cook Islands, yeah.
Micronesia. Yeah. Cook Islands.
And that's when, from there, I've watched ever since. And definitely a way to connect with Joe, as we don't live together, like, in the same area. So it was kind of a let's watch this and then talk about it kind of show. And then it just, yes, we were pitching new ideas. It was.
So, Kate, you're going in and out a little bit. I got part of it. So we'll see if maybe the internet, I don't know. We'll see.
I'm so sorry. Should I turn my video off?
If you want to try that, I just won't, you know, we won't be able to see like the cues, but if you want to try that and see if that'll work better. Yeah. Like, it's in and out. So,
I'm really sorry.
No, it's all good. So when you sit down, I was looking through this and you dive into pretty much everything with Survivor here, where you start off with, you know, how the game came to be. I'm trying to pull up the contents here. So it was reality TV and fans making Survivor, game structure and player strategy, twists and advantages, court and controversy, identity and evolution. He broke this into three parts: production, the game, the social experiment. Why did you want to start with reality TV and fans?
I mean, part of it is to really capture for that cultural history of television how significant Survivor is for introducing reality TV, which is now one of the, you know, a very well-known genre. Even if you don't watch reality TV shows, you know what reality TV is. And one thing that we found that I didn't know when we started the research, like when I find news articles from the year 2000 when Survivor's premiering, they don't have the term reality TV. They don't know what to call this yet. The New York Times calls it televoyeur entertainment, like dramality gets thrown around. We now think of reality TV, which is a very big umbrella. Like there's so many things that are part of reality TV, but that's just part of the landscape of entertainment. And there are reality TV stars. That's part of celebrity culture. It's part of both mainstream television and cable television and streaming, that there's going to be reality TV shows. That didn't exist when Survivor came about. There were a couple of things that we would now call reality TV that predate Survivor, like The Real World on MTV. But that hadn't broken out wide enough to essentially, you know, define a genre of television the way Survivor did when it came out in 2000. So to understand the significance on the television industry, we kind of had to step back and say, this is how big a deal Survivor was. It was unfathomable that something like Survivor as a summer show in the year 2000 would end up reshaping the entertainment landscape. But it absolutely did. And so to get that kind of bird's eye view, we felt like we need to step back and kind of talk through the idea of reality TV. And then, you know, with reality TV, it's a different type of celebrity culture and fan culture that develops around that than what had existed before, too. So that became part of that section of the book that's called, about the production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I thought it was really interesting, you know, how you're breaking that down and talking about how in 2000 there was no word for this, because I think a lot of times, you know, we have our fans come in and out, right? Like we've had fans, I've been doing this for 10 years. So we've had fans who have stuck with us for 10 years since Worlds Apart was the first full season that I did on this channel. And then you have people who though are jumping in now, who didn't start till the new era, who didn't start till season 45, who maybe this is their first season and they're just going back and they're watching older seasons. Because of the landscape that we're in now, especially over like the last 15 years, even more, you take for granted that this has just been here forever. And I think that's what's really cool about Survivor is like, I take for granted that it's just going to be here every Wednesday of my life or every Thursday from back in the early days. But like Wednesday nights, I could tell somebody if they said, hey, this October, we have something going on Wednesday night, I'm going to be like, sorry, I got to do my podcast Wednesday night. Like I know that. And if you said that 3 years from now, I'd say, I know that this is going to be happening. But in 2000, there was no sense of what this was actually going to be because it just wasn't something people were looking for. So I love looking at the history of Survivor because my first episode was season 2, episode 2, when it was right after Deb had been voted out. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with it right away. And now if you go back and you watch Australia, it feels like archaic at this point. It's like, that's a totally
different show. It's so much about it is different. The gameplay is different because there's so much that the production has added that was not there. But even the technology, like those are standard def seasons. When you go back and watch the early seasons of Survivor, which like technology has evolved while the show has been on the air to make it feel different. And then obviously there's also the editing style and so many cultural elements that are present there in the early 2000s that aren't, around now, but there's still like a core of Survivor that just works. Like there, it really is a concept that you don't need to mess with too much. the idea of putting these people on, you know, a contained space, they have to vote someone out. And in the end, someone has to get $1 million and the people have been voted out to choose who that is. Like, that works as a concept. And so I understand people who go back and say, like, Borneo is really slow, or, you know, Australian Outback is really slow. And it is a slower pace that's present in the in those episodes. But also, like, the core of what's happening there absolutely still entertains me.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Kate, let's make sure, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. You said you started with Cook Islands with Yule and Ozzy and stuff. Is it weird for you to go back to those early, early seasons? Like, do you enjoy them as much rewatching them, or are you more into like everything 13 and beyond?
I'm definitely more into 13 and beyond just because that's my original, and it's weird to me without like an immunity idol. It's a different game to me, but it is fascinating to go back and be like, this is the origin. This is how, what they learned from to get to that point.
And so without the immunity idol and things like that, but now we've gotten to this point, and you talk about twists and advantages a lot. You give the Medallion of Power rightfully. It's, you destroy it, both of you, in this book, which it deserves to be. But have you felt like either of you have felt like that it's like gone too far? It's just become like too chaotic at this point and there's nothing left. You know, you said the core is still there from season one, season two, Joe, but do you feel like it's starting to kind of fall away from what that core was?
I don't mind in kind of in principle a lot of the twists that have been added, you know, in from the new era on. Like, there's lots of things that I think have been controversial. I'm not a fan of all of them, obviously, like the hourglass twist. Most of us, I think, agree maybe was a too much power. My issue is the amount of twists and advantages that have been introduced in the same season. Like Kate and I were talking about, like, we're writing a book on Survivor and we're watching this week's episode and we can't remember who has what, and that's affecting the strategy. So it's hard to follow the strategy because there's so many individual advantages that people have, and that should be affecting how they're going to play. But if we can't remember it because there's so many as fans and as dedicated fans who are watching the show very closely, and we struggle sometimes to remember who has what, I think that's where it becomes problematic. And I wish they would pull back the number of advantages that are out there at any given time and are going to be played in a particular season.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, that's the biggest thing. This last week's episode that we watched was when, you know, Star goes home. For anybody who's listening to this in the future, this is what we're watching. And I had pretty much convinced myself, because somebody had tweeted it out at us on the internet and said, hey, Mitch has his extra vote still. And in my head, I was like, oh, okay, Mitch has an extra vote then. Like, I didn't even think to question it because I'm at the point now where I'm like, I knew Mitch had something. I forget if Mitch played the something he had. And what's going on here? And then it turns out that no, like, Mitch never actually had an extra vote. He had a block of vote and he used that block of vote already. But I do agree with that, where there's a lot going on and that can be a little complicated, especially in what is this faster paced game, as you get into a lot in this book of 26 days versus 39 days, which is a big discussion amongst the fans. It's a big discussion amongst the players. And when you have 26 versus 39 with so many advantages, there's, you know, you might not necessarily think you're going to feel that, but there's not as much time to let that stuff breathe and develop mm-hmm. in the show, because it has to come and go really quickly.
Yeah, I completely agree. Kate, are you able to jump in here? I don't want to be the only one speaking if you're available.
No, sorry. I'm so sorry about my video. I feel like I can't jump in to interrupt. I do agree on all of it. It's too much. And it's also, to me, too random. Like, there's so many ones where it's just roll this dice and see what happens. And I like ones where it's a beware one and you have to earn it and get it. But I'm also torn because I hate it that you lose your vote if you don't get it, because I think you should always have your vote. It's your only power in the game. So it's not, it bothers me that you don't have your vote, but I like the challenge of you have to do something to earn an advantage rather than it just being the luck of the draw that you either get this advantage or you lose your vote and you're just screwed come tribal.
Mm-hmm. It feels a little bit like production's having some trouble calibrating how difficult it is to obtain the advantage, because it feels like, and I'd have to go double check all the numbers, mostly players lose and don't get the advantage when it is a luck one. But if it's like, hey, go complete this challenge or go sneak out at night, like they always do those ones. Like they don't
fail on those. Did that crazy puzzle with like the rope where you have to figure out how to
get that. Yes, that one was, yeah. That one, I don't think. Yeah, talk about calibration. There was zero chance, I think, of anyone with all the time in the world on the island completing that one. So that one, they went too far in making it too hard. When they go out and they've just got to roll dice and whatever happens, that's not super satisfying. But if it's like, hey, solve this puzzle in under 3 minutes, and pretty much everyone solves the puzzle in under 3 minutes, that's also not quite as satisfying.
Yeah. So Kate, we're hearing you good now. So I think the no video is working. So feel free to jump in. We just can't really see you here. But I want to talk, since we're talking about these idols and stuff already, I want to talk about how you guys break this down in here. And I don't know how much you want me to spoil, because I want people to go and buy your book and everything. But you break down the eras of Survivor. And I thought it was very interesting how you didn't just start the new era, and you won't call it the new era, but you don't start this newest era with just the beginning of 41. You actually include Island of the Idols and Winners at War in that era. And I think that's very smart, because I'm thinking of Jamal Shipman walking down the island and finding a thing dangling in front of his face, taking it and being punished for that. And I think that kind of set the tone for what was to come. But what made you choose to do that?
Yeah, and I'm fine if we run through what the errors are. That's in our appendix, not a huge, bulk of the book. But that's what we ended up calling the Beware era, this most recent time. For one reason, calling anything the new era is always a mistake, because time marches on. We're already, I think, starting to feel like, are we still in the new era? Should we be calling this? Not necessarily because something has changed in the game, but just because we've been around this for, 4 years now. So it doesn't feel particularly new anymore. But I thought both that moment with Jamal, and then in Winners at War, with things like Tony having, having to go rustle up six fire tokens or else he'd be punished. Like, that's a different flavor of the game than what we had seen before. And with all the errors, like, there's probably some strands that you could see beforehand of things, but it felt like some dynamic is shifting here. And there are obviously massive changes 41 on in terms of the casting, in terms of the amount of time they spend on the island, that makes it very convenient to label that as its own era from then on. But I felt like there was something that was, you could feel a change happening before 41 even came.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kate, anything there?
No, just, yeah, it was a long discussion on our end of when do we hit this point? What makes this the break of one era to the other? But it's like any, people still say old school, new school, and it's like, well, what was new school? Because it's now also old school, and when did that switch happen? So you got to relabel things and take out the new and old aspect.
Yeah, and I think that's so fair. It's so funny to me, because my wife has not seen all the seasons, so we're making our way through all of them. She's watched all the new era seasons, or what is the new era now, seasons with me, because that was like when we started dating and then got married and everything. So she's actually seen every season from your Beware era. So she started in Island of the Idols and somehow still watches the show.
Ooh, and that's a rough first season.
Yeah, but it's very funny to me, because now we're going back and we're on Samoa, and I always think of Samoa as like, that's kind of your turning point of like, you're Tokenchin, Samoa, Gabon, you're into like old school you're into like the new era of the old school stuff. And I always think of Heroes Villains as like, there's everything before Heroes Villains and there's everything after Heroes Villains. And now I'm like, well, it's too many seasons. Like, at this point, Samoa is like so old, and it's like almost in like the first third of the show, which is weird to have to explain of like, no, like what Russell's doing is so unheard of at this time. You've just seen people do this kind of stuff for 8 seasons because of how he essentially broke the game.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird to go back and think that people didn't used to just walk around looking for idols. And now that's, often one of the very first things that people do when they get on the island, and everyone's on guard for who's out there looking for idols. And no one knew what Russell was doing, because why would you go look for an idol? Like, what? It didn't cross anyone's mind. Unless you have clues, you're not going to find it. And Russell's just like, that thing looks weird, I'm going to go look there. That Tokenchin and Samoa, that's what we called the start of the personality era, where it seems like both production and players start shifting towards celebrating the, you know, the biggest personalities that are there on the island. And in some instances, it feels like maybe they're creating characters that they're performing on the island more than just being themselves, which is, you know, maybe a negative that comes from this personality era. But it is absolutely something different than what we've been seeing before. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were looking for as we're trying to lay out these eras. So like, okay, where, whether it's coming from production or how players are approaching the game, does it feel like something significant has changed? And anytime you're trying to break something into eras, there's always, one of my favorite examples is the frayed rope. Like, okay, you're identifying the sections of the rope, but there's frays that go out both ways, you know, before and after this particular era. But you're saying like, okay, the body of this rope, this is the personality era. There's some frayed edges that are seeping into the earlier era, and you're going to be lingering into the next era that we identify. But it's where can you see some significant transition from how the game is being produced?
And I think, you know, when I'm looking at like the people you list out here for the personality era, some of them, if you're going back and watching the seasons, you're going, those people had no impact on the show. But I think it's fascinating when you start to talk about the stunt casting with like famous athletes. And, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking about the Freys. Crystal Cox is one of those Freys there with Gabon. But then Steve Wright and Grant Matos, people that nobody talks about anymore. But they were like, here's NFL players, Cliff Robinson, Brad Culpepper. You know, Taj is married to Eddie George, Lisa Welchel. That was such a big deal when that happened. And she's mm-hmm. on the same season as Jeff Kent. It is funny how that happened, but it didn't necessarily work because a lot of the seasons that those players played in aren't really well received. And then we see somebody like Mike White come out and play, and almost everybody knew who he was. And he's on a tribe with Johnny Mundo, who's like, you know, a big time wrestler and everything. And that season's one of the best. So it's kind of like, you know, I think Survivor kind of learned from that stunt casting, as you call it, of they learned that that's not necessarily the best way to make the show. But if those characters work, then put them in, but don't base it around them.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like Mike White wandering around with a wine glass, that is an iconic moment of Survivor, but it's not because that's famous Mike White here on the island playing the game. It's because Mike White was being himself, you know, in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Do both of you have a favorite era?
So we can run down real quick. There's the original era is what we call everything before the individual immunity idol gets introduced. And then the classic era is where we get the individual immunity idol, a lot of the teens there. And then the personality era is what we were just talking about. That goes from Token Sheens to Worlds Apart. And then we called it the advantages era, Cambodia to Edge of Extinction, where there's just a lot of advantages starting to be thrown in. And now the beware era, where it's not just that advantages exist, it's that there's going to be a price to be paid to get the advantages. I know that there are many people who will have more eras than that. They'll get more granular in how they break it down. It's kind of interesting because I have like a fan attachment to almost all of these eras because I was there watching in that original era. The classic era has a lot of really fantastic seasons. It's a really strong run there in that classic era. And you mentioned like the martyr approach. That's one of my very favorite episodes of Survivor, you know, and that's there in the personality era. So I don't know if I have like in particular a favorite era. I think one thing I've noticed as myself is like, I'm always enjoying what's coming out, but to like really appreciate it, I need some distance to be able to like step back and think about it. So like, is the Beware era my favorite? No, but maybe in, you know, once we've entered something else and I'm looking back 5 years, I'll say, you know what, there's some excellent casting, you know, in that era and some really fun gameplay came out.
What about for you, Kate?
Oh, it is very hard to say. There's definitely hit and miss in all of them, but I'm really partial to the advantages era that we list from Cambodia to Edge of Extinction. I just think there's really strong casting and gameplay that I find the most fun to watch.
And I was shocked because, so this, just for everybody who's listening to understand, and I should probably let you guys plug when this is coming out. I forgot to do that at the beginning. So, but you have an iconic player section in the appendix, you have the eras listed in the appendix, and you also have your season tiers listed in the appendix. Mm-hmm. You decided to go tiers instead of ranking. And for Wendell Holland, if you're listening to this, I don't know if you listen to all of our stuff here, but if Wendell Holland's listening to this, you all gave Ghost Island a 4-star very good. And so, Kate, I think that speaks to when you're saying, you know, you're really into this advantages era. That's normally a season that people are like, wow, we really like the tie. But everything else is just kind of like whatever. So it's fun to see how like there's different perspectives on everything. And sometimes when I get so caught up in this was my opinion the entire time, so this must be the opinion, it's fun to see some differing opinions there and see Wendell and Dom get some credit as a 4-star season.
Yeah, there was a lot of debate about the season's rankings or tiers, as we, like, we're not within the tier. We're not saying this is number one in this tier. We just say, yeah, this is a 5-star season. This is a 4-star season. This is a 3-star. And like the first time we kind of ran through our rankings, we're like, we actually have probably way too many 5-star seasons if we're going to make that significant and like feel like you've really got to be, you know, a top, you know, percentile of Survivor if you're gonna be a 5-star season. So we moved some stuff down and oh my goodness, there was a lot of back and forth for us on that. And it's like you said, there's gonna be people who disagree with that. Ghost Island has the tie, so it has, you know, some historic weight to it. And I, as cheesy as it is, I actually did enjoy like the callbacks to like the self-referential lore of Survivor. Like I think that's not a strong season if you're trying to introduce someone to Survivor, but if you're the kind of fan that watches and rewatches Survivor, that's one that has a lot of payoffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. That is fair. Once Upon an Island is in the chat here. He says, I got to get this book. You mentioned Once Upon an Island quite a few times throughout. I felt like I was reading like tidbits and quotes from my friends throughout. So when does this book come out and where can people find it so that we don't get too far into this podcast and then finally start to talk about this?
The book is called Survivor Cultural History. Its official release date, I believe, is May 25th. I'm double checking that right now. It is the end of this month is when it's going to be coming out. And it should be available at most 20th, May 20th. Thank you. Thank you. It's available on Amazon. It's available on its publisher's website, which is Roman and Littlefield. You should be able to ask a bookstore to order it at this point, and they'd be able to let you know once it comes in, and they should get it, you know, that release date. So it is coming up quick. It's one of those weird things when you work on this kind of a project that, like, we dedicated a couple years of our lives to this, and then it went into a black box. You know, where we sent in the manuscript and then the publisher like sent us back the proofs, and it's like, okay, you need to immediately like make this your life again right now. And you read through the proofs, you copy edit, make an index about this. And we go through all that, and then we send that back, and it's back in a black box. And we're just kind of like, okay, when is this going to happen? But it's very exciting to know that the physical copies are going to be available in just a few weeks here.
Yeah. No, that's great. And I thought it was so interesting, as you're saying all that, you still mentioned to put in plenty of references to season 46. I know it this book only goes up through 46, mm-hmm. and you mentioned how 47 and 48 are taking place, but you mentioned plenty about Maria and Charlie. Like, you were able to get that in. So that's impressive. Out of the black box, you put that in.
That was an interesting one.
Yeah, so that was one of our goals, was like, okay, how, like, we know we're not going to be up to date for when this releases, but we want it to feel as up to date as is possible. And one of the big stories was the Maria and Charlie, storyline that was as we were like working on our final pass of the book, right, Kate?
Yeah.
So we live in different states. I flew out to my sister's house to work on that final pass of the book. And I think that's when we were putting in the Maria and Charlie stuff, is like, okay, we're actually face to face. We're sitting here. We're talking through this. What can we get that makes this as timely as is possible?
Yeah. And I thought you both did a very good job of that. And so, let's talk about, you know, before we went live here, I was like, oh, I really want to talk about, you know, what you kind of bring up towards the end of this, which is there's been almost 700 people now. I think it is over 700 people who've played Survivor, and there's people that during the early days were unbelievably popular, right? Unbelievably popular. And then as we've moved away from them, maybe they're not as good of TV when you look back. It's something a little cringy or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. How did you feel when you were both writing about that and having those discussions about, you know, some of the uglier moments in the show's history. You talk a lot about the Hatch and Sue situation. You obviously covered the Dan Spilo situation, the Zeke and Varner situation. You cover a lot of these, but especially in those earlier seasons, you were talking about some of the casting decisions that production was making of, like, they're purposefully trying to put people who would literally hate each other near each other. What was it like to kind of go back and look through that? And as you were watching these seasons back, was there anything that was glaring where you're like, I didn't remember it like that, and now it really stands out to you?
Kate, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I would say a lot of the earlier seasons rewatching was kind of shocking what they got away with putting on. I think especially Amazon as a whole is, wow. I can't believe that's on TV in this time now, looking back. Obviously at the time that was just par for the course. And definitely some of the things that Jeff says is also really surprising. But that was just the culture. He wasn't doing anything like radical. It was just the time period. And so I think that's one of the most fascinating things about going back and writing on this, is that in just the 20 years, there's such a shift in culture, and Survivor had to move along with the times. And you can see it point blank, like through the eras of the show, of like, you can't say things like this anymore. You can't have girls take their tops off anymore. You can't be naked anymore. You can't sleep close to each other anymore. There has to be a 6-inch bamboo between you. Like, things like that are really fascinating to me.
Because there were whole storylines built around, you know, Jean Robert wants to cuddle with Courtney, and Courtney's like, I'm 75 pounds, dude. What's wrong with you? I'm not keeping anybody warm. I can't even keep myself warm. Like, and that was a whole storyline. I mean, and you think about the chocolate and peanut butter situation in Amazon, like you're saying, Kate, it's like crazy to think that was on TV. That was probably the most or second most iconic moment of the show up to that point, other than maybe Scoop and falling in the fire. Which is another thing that you cover in the book.
Yeah, you can't look at it the same way. So some of the changes in how we receive these, it's because culture has moved. There's a phrase that, like, the past is a foreign country, and like, you really can't always understand. And this is showing that within 25 years from when the show premiered to today, it's already changed that much that you look back and you're like, oh, okay. You know, they were comfortable saying that particular slur, you know, casually on a broadcast, you know, broadcast television, or, you know, the whole thing that you just mentioned with you know, the chocolate and peanut butter, like, production is like, this isn't about gameplay, this is about production is saying, if you flash us, we will give you this treat. It's like, you're not getting an advantage of the game, you're not getting, like, it's just for the titillation of viewers, we're willing to you know, give you your demand here, which they're in on it. Like, that's an important part of it. It's like, you know, Jenna and Heidi were in on it and comfortable with doing that. But it's like, when you think back at, like, what do you have to do to earn chocolate and peanut butter? It's not give up your vote or anything. You know, it's flash, and that definitely would not happen today. Then there's the version where it's like, okay, these are real people. These aren't, you know, characters that were being written and performed. These are real people. And sometimes, you know, with something like Scoopin', you know, later revelations make you unable to go and watch those scene, you know, any scene with him the same way that you did before. Mm-hmm. And so there's so much that kind of change the audience reception of Survivor. And that's one of the fascinating things about popular culture is, you know, that it's always like simultaneously reflecting the culture that's at and then influencing the culture, right? There's in pop culture theory, there's something called the magic mirror theory. That's like a piece of entertainment is both reflecting culture and influencing the people who are consuming it. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you look at an old, you know, movie and it has a scene that's pretty racist, and you're like, okay, was that scene pretty racist, like casually racist because society was casually racist, or was society casually racist because they were watching a lot of racist entertainment? And the answer is, of course, yes, to both of those. And with Survivor now, 25 years, you got multiple decades of a show that's airing constantly. Of course, there's gonna be reflections of where things were, and that's not where we are now. And as you said, like, you can't go watch it without 2025 eyes. Like, we all have 2025 eyes. And so maybe our eyebrows go up when we see something, and we got to do some work to contextualize it, and not approve of it, but understand, you know, where things were at that moment. And also, we were careful to make a point of, giving some grace to these people who had these moments recorded and, you know, broadcasted on TV. I made a point of using an excerpt from Rob Cesternito where he talks about watching his old season of Survivor and saying, like, what was I saying? Like, I was not I could not speak to suddenly I'm blanking on the person's name. It was the Asian American, and he says,
Dan Liu.
That's it. Yeah, where Dan says, like, you know, I feel like a little bit of an outsider as the only Asian American, and Rob is defending himself and everyone else by saying, well, we're not doing anything to treat you that way. And Rob's sister, you know, watching that back during the pandemic, he like chewed his past self out because Rob has changed, right? Rob Cesternino recognizes that, you know, what I said as I think it was early 20s, right?
He's 23, I think, if that.
Yeah, or early 20s, 20 years ago, is not what I would say now. So, in some of these instances, we got to extend some grace and hope that, you know, people have grown, and many of the players have shown evidence of that growth. So it's not just look back at this time capsule that's frozen in amber of this moment where maybe someone said something controversial and, you know, condemn them today, which you see happen on social media every now and then, where it's like someone's watching an old season and they're dredging something up and they're chewing out someone for something they did 15 years ago. Is that still relevant? Not always. Now, something like Scoopin, of course, like, let's all say Scoopin, scumbag. We're not gonna, you know, say anything about that one.
Yeah. And I found it fascinating. You called it like known versus unknowing viewer, right? Like, like when I'm watching, so I have a friend who is watching Philippines for the first time right now. And because I'm the Survivor guy, you know, he texts me and he'll be like, hey man, we're watching, you know, we're building a gazebo in our yard and we're watching Survivor. And one, that makes me mad because I'm like, you should focus on Survivor. You don't build a gazebo and watch Survivor. But then he's talking about how like he can't stand Abby Maria and he can't stand Scoopin. And I said, well, here's the deal with Scoopin. And I told him, and he goes, there's no way. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, well, now I'm glad I didn't tell you I love him. And I'm like, but you're an unknowing viewer. Like, you don't understand what this is. And I do think that's very interesting when you go back and you watch it and you even get into gameplay a little bit with JT and you all talk about how, you know, JT's games and Heroes, Villains and Game Changers don't nearly live up to what he did in Token Chains. So can you still watch his game in Token Chains and have the same level of respect for it, knowing what comes after that? I think it's a really interesting discussion, but I do think it's great. And you do a good job of it in the book of giving grace here, because I think what makes Survivor so amazing compared to some other TV shows is because Survivor is real people. They can't just sit there and say, oh, we're going to cut this episode out. Like, we're going to get, you know, we're going to upload everything to Netflix, but we're going to cut one or two episodes out because they were offensive. It's like, no, these are real people. And every episode, somebody's getting voted out. You can't just dump an episode. Like, it's all there. Like you said, it's in the DVD sets. It's in all that. And so we're hearing what real people are saying. And based on what the edit of them is, how Jeff is reacting to them, how the rest of the cast is reacting to them, gives you a sense of how the viewers were also reacting to them. There's a lot of things, like you were saying, in season one, Sean uses some words in that season and Hatch is laughing. Hatch is going along with it. And he's now, you'd be horrified if somebody said that on TV, you'd be like, get out of here. But back then that wasn't the case. And I think it's fascinating to be able to watch that. And I'm a big fan of don't cancel people for things that they said 25 years ago. It's one thing if you like murdered somebody, or in the case of Scoop, and if you did what he did, it's like, yes, you can be canceled. But I feel like when you're watching a TV show, like obviously we have Survivor 50 coming up, and people are always talking about, oh, are they going to put Stephanie LaGrosa on because of everything she said in Palau? It's like, they made her a hero. And Heroes versus
she was. Yeah, she was so popular in Palau. I think Guatemala is the one where it's like, oh, maybe the shine is coming off a little bit.
Yeah. Well, she uses one word in particular over and over in both of those seasons where you're like, wow, they would never air that now. And honestly, we watched Stephanie on The Traitors a couple years ago. She's obviously very aware of the fact that you don't do that now. And I think that's like the hard thing. People want to go back and cancel for 20 years ago. And it's like, it wasn't frowned upon, you know, like in some circles it might've been, but as the culture as a whole, there was a different reaction to some of the words and some of the things that were being said, some of the actions that were taking place, which Survivor is really one of the only shows where you can really look for 25 years. I mean, to put that in perspective, like earlier, from 1925 to 1950, like think about the changes that happened in the world. And we're talking 2000 to 2025, like massive changes with technology and things like that. And I just, you know, you have to remember that it's a big time period, big time period. So yeah, that was one of my favorites.
It's always interesting to me that one of the things that dates the early seasons of Survivor most is actually the technology, which you're like, well, it's Survivor. What technology is there? It's like, well, Jeff's like rolling out a TV card with a VHS player and a box TV. And it's like, that feels weird. Or when they do the chat in Australia and, you know, Outback, it's like, this is the most modern technology imaginable. And it's like, okay. And also the cars, right? The cars always. It's like you look at those now and you're like, oh, was that a prize? Was that?
My favorite is in Samoa when they put the idle clue on the Sprint Palm Prix. And that's in 2009. And I'm looking at that thing and I'm like, it's a slide. I don't even think it was a slide phone. I think it was just a regular like dinosaur phone with buttons at the bottom. And you could just, you had pictures. And Jeff was like, oh, take pictures. It's going to be great. Capture these moments. And they're showing the picture. You're like, it's HD because it's edited in HD. Like, that's literally the only reason these look good. It's just so funny that that's what they were using. And only 2 or 3 years later, almost every single person had an iPhone in their hand.
Yeah. And like, you don't think about how much, you know, time shifts so quickly, but it really does stand out when you see those examples, like you said, like that was the height of cell phone technology and it looks quaint, you know, today.
Yeah. Another thing that you talked about here was the uses and gratification theory, which I feel like was like probably the most like academic thing you brought up in this book, which I feel like we've kind of talked about it a little bit. But could you like dive into that a little bit more and why you wanted to bring that in with Survivor?
Yeah. So, I mean, uses gratification theory is a theory that goes back to when radio was first becoming popular as a mass medium that was in people's home. And it's the first time where people had like access to media all the time, and academics and also producers were like, well, why are they choosing what to listen to, what they're listening to? Because before you had to leave the home to go to the movie theater, if that's what you were going to do, or you went and bought a book and you had a book on your shelf. But now it's like anytime you can just switch the dial and you're on one of the stations that's here. And so they were trying to track what audiences used media for and what gratifications they were trying to achieve, whether it was, intellectual curiosity or escape understanding another culture or just straight up entertainment. Like there's all these different values that they put into uses and gratification theory. And one reason that I brought that into Survivor, the discussion of Survivor, was it feels like sometimes when we talk about these controversial moments, the producers are expecting one type of, or trying to produce for one type of appeal. And then there's segments of the audience that are coming to Survivor for something else. Entirely. So production is always, always, always touting Survivor as the greatest social experiment ever put on TV. And they want to explore issues of race and gender and sexuality and have, you know, players talk about these parts of their personalities and their lives and see how they interact and how that changes the game. But then there's a segment of fans that come and just want escape. And they're like, well, why are we having this political discussion about race, I cited a couple of journal articles that published, like they went through online posts about, Drea and Marianne played their idols and had a whole discussion about race. And they went and studied like, okay, here's all the different kinds of reactions that we're getting. And I think some of those reactions are because people were coming to Survivor for one thing and were being given something else. You know, they were being given an educational moment and they just want escape entertainment right there. And so, is the moment itself controversial? Is it the audience reaction that's controversial? Is it some misalignment between those things that is making this into a hot button issue for Survivor fandom? And so that was just an interesting, way to explore some of what a lot of fans will call like the political moments on Survivor. Mm-hmm.
Are there any, I know, Kate, you talked about, Amazon especially, but are there any moments that, you felt watching back that maybe you were like really excited to watch back, or like something that you remembered enjoying that you then just hated on this rewatch to get ready for this book?
Oh, wow. That's a good question.
I remember one that you mentioned to me, not that you hated, but just you had a completely different reaction. And that was just Ozzy as a player in general.
He did change for me. I used to love him. And I still do. Like, he's very entertaining and obviously a great player. It's just a different kind of love now. but the what's the one with Amanda?
China. Or is it Micronesia, one of those two?
Where he, both him and Amanda, and he's like...
Oh, Micronesia, yeah.
Micronesia.
Yes. And the speech he gives her when he, at the, you know, at the
Final
end,
trouble.
Yeah. is just shocking to me. I didn't remember it in my love of him. And again, I'm not putting him down as a player. It just, I didn't remember it in that way. And it, I view it very differently now in a rewatch.
Yeah, there's a couple Final Tribal speeches where you look back and you're like, man, that's got to be embarrassing to think back on now. Or like, especially, you know, again, going to the whole knowing viewer, like Ozzy and Amanda aren't dating. Ozzy and Amanda don't stay together. They don't get together. Nothing like that happens. So to hear that speech and how passionate it is and everything, and it's kind of hard not to watch with like, a, oh, Ozzy, you sweet, like 25-year-old who thought that this was like this big moment. And now we look back and we're like, what's Ozzy doing now? Not married to Amanda, that's for sure. So,
yeah. What's Amanda doing? I think she's somewhere in Wyoming, I think.
She better be somewhere in Fiji in about 3 weeks. That's all I'm going to say. She better be somewhere in Fiji.
Well, on the flip side of just that is watching back like Rob and Amber, and you know that they're still together and have multiple daughters, and it did work out. And that's nice to know that in a rewatch, that this love story they're painting did end up together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've mentioned a couple times that knowing versus unknowing, which is, I borrowed from adaptation theory, which is when someone knows the source material and they watch an adaptation, they're having a different experience than someone who the adaptation is their first exposure to, you know, Pride and Prejudice or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I just applying it to reality TV, it's like, how in depth are the fans in terms of knowing? You know, do they follow these players on social media? Do they know who's together? You know, that Ozzy and Amanda never end up together. That changes your experience versus someone who's just watching these episodes and that's all they get. You know, this insulated experience of watching Survivor. They, as you already know, might have a very different reaction to Scoopin' than a knowing viewer. Someone who's deep in the fandom and knows the lore.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like that's always fun for me because obviously I come on here, I do these podcasts, I do all this, but I started watching the show when I was 8 years old, 9 years old with my parents. And, you know, that was a lot of fun. And my parents still watch to this day. They watch every episode. They're rooting for Joe, David, and Eva on this season. David's gone. That broke my mom's heart. Like, it's funny to see that perspective. And then like, we'll talk about certain things or, you know, you whatever it was with Mary talking about, oh, I'm pretending I'm hugging my boyfriend. It's like, well, Mary's not dating that guy. I don't know if she ever was or if that was just a joke in the first place. But my parents are watching it being like, oh, that's nice. That's about her boyfriend. And it's like, well, no, not really. like we know that it's not because we're looking at the online space and everything. And I think that is it's probably the biggest gap between Survivor fans. I think if there's like one differentiator between people in this community, it is kind of that knowing versus unknowing, because the people who listen to us, I forget that that's not the norm. Like there's 4.6 million people who watch this show every week. And those people, you know, even Rob, who might put up 100,000 views / listens a week, that means that there's 4.5 million people who aren't listening to Rob and aren't listening to us or Tyson or reading Mike Bloom or even maybe the most they do is read Entertainment Weekly because they've been reading Dalton since season 4 or 5.
Yeah,
you know? So yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's the fandom is so big. And even like when you know, that paper about like the audience reception theory, like the people who took the time to go post angry reactions to, you know, to this discussion of race on Survivor, that's still such a minuscule fraction of Survivor fans that would go write anything online to go be part of the online fan community. Like the vast majority of people who watch Survivor are probably having a fairly insular experience of watching the episode, maybe talking with immediate family or, you know, chat messages with someone else they know watches Survivor. Most aren't, you know, jumping onto the podcast, reading the online commentaries, you know, posting on Reddit or those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's hard for sometimes all of us to remember when we live and breathe. I mean, you wrote a, what is this, 230 page or 215 page book about it. I've done 10 years of podcasting. It's hard to remember that. That's not normal. That's not what people actually always do. So,
but it's it is part of fandom today. Like the internet has created these very deep fandoms, which is Survivor has somehow managed to do both of having that broad, shallow fandom and the incredibly deep fandom. And there are some shows that are surviving just on broad fandoms and some that are only have that very dedicated deep fandom. And I think Survivor has struck a pretty good balance of both appealing to both kinds of fandoms and also creating a product that services both fandoms.
Mm-hmm. Well, and thinking about, you reference a lot talking about sports and Survivor as kind of a sport where it has all these talk shows and people who just, we don't have a network dedicated to talking about Survivor. But if you come to YouTube, if you type in Survivor 48 episode 10 recap, you're going to find 20 different recaps just on YouTube. Who knows how many more you're going to find on Spotify and stuff, people that don't have YouTube channels. And I think that is, it's interesting to think about the fact that we do treat it like a sport. And that's where, for me, I like advantages. Like, for me, if I was to go by your eras, even though I wish that you included token chains in the classic era so I could really say classic, like, I think that stretch from 11 to 20 is the best stretch the show ever had. And I don't think it'll ever be topped. And I think the reason is people always say, we don't want advantages. We don't want that. You do want advantages. You just want fewer. You do want advantages. You just want one or two or three per season, because those were the best seasons and that's what we were looking at. And I just think that that's like, that's a fun way to just look at the show, like through that lens of, what do audiences really, really want? And
yeah. When people complain about the changes, you need to remember, like, a tribe swap and an individual immunity idol were both surprises the first time they happened. Mm-hmm. And the immunity idol not coming until season 11, like, that is weird to me that you can watch 10 seasons of Survivor with no individual immunity idol that can be found. And that one is an example of a twist that has become so core to the show that it feels like an absence. Like, you feel a hole when it's not there. And with some of the newer twists, give it enough time and some of them are probably going to feel like they're core parts of the show as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like right now, if there wasn't an idol on a season, I think people wouldn't know what to do with themselves. They would think that that's what they want. But if the general audience is pretty, at least the online community is pretty bored by season 48 right now, that's been the general sentiment I feel that we've seen in a lot. And if you don't have idols, you're kind of getting this straightforward, we got the dominant alliance, that's what's going to take place. So I don't think people necessarily don't want idols. I just think it's finding that happy medium of where we would go. And I don't know.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. Like you said, the online discourse is that the season's become kind of boring. And I think it's because there's this dominant alliance. So like when David, went home, it was like, oh, do we have a fracturing? Is this, is it going to come through? And then when it doesn't, that ends up being a little disappointing.
Yeah. So I'm gonna ask this one to you, Kate. You have your Mount Rushmore on here.
Mm-hmm.
Who was like it between there at the end? Because I think the first three that you put, and you guys are okay with me sharing this, right? Because I know it's also. But so you have Sandra, Tony, and Boston Rob. Now I'm not gonna reveal the fourth person to anybody yet. But Kate, who was this last spot between? Because I feel like those first three, almost everybody's gonna agree with.
If I recall correctly, this wasn't a big debate between us. We were kind of like, that's our girl. But I think a lot of fans would say it should have been Parvati.
I mean, but I don't necessarily. I'm not a lot of fans, Kate. So I just wanted to put two other people on the spot to be in agreement with me that Parvati's not a Mount Rushmore, because I've been saying that and getting hate from Parvati fans.
She's not. Sorry to those who think she is, and her herself thinks she is. But to us, we put who we put with pretty much solid agreement, I think. Yep. Did we disagree, Joe?
No. I think once we had the same four when we were floating. Like, okay, if we're doing Mount Rushmore, who do we have? And we made our blind list and compared, and then we were like, yeah, well, that's it. And so, I mean, Survivor built a half of a Mount Rushmore for us already. So like, there's no doubt about Boston, Rob, and Sandra. And then you have another two-time winner. So like you said, there's no debate there. And then it's the fourth. And I think to be on the Survivor Mount Rushmore and to be one of the best Survivor players ever, you don't have to be a winner. Because some of the best players, luck doesn't go their way. And that is why we have Ceree Fields is the fourth member of our Mount Rushmore.
Yeah. Saree Fields. And I don't disagree with it. I always feel like if Micronesia is a final three, Amanda and Parvati willingly took her to final three, thinking it was a final three, Saree would have cleaned up. Mm-hmm. She would have cleaned up once they got to hear her pitch at the end, because Parvati's final tribal only looks great because Amanda's is so bad. So that helped. I was surprised. Hey, I will say, though, in your iconic players, you have a typo because you don't have Michelle Fitzgerald. And that's, well, that
is the harder. Like, we did not have a debate about the Mount Rushmore. We did have a debate where we're like, how many players can we put into our iconic players, like, just to make this a reasonable list? And there were some hard cuts. Jeremy Collins, this, I think, also did them again. That was so, like, Michelle and Jeremy were like, oh, I think those were the two. We're like, ah. And we wanted to make sure we were awesome.
Down too?
I'd have to go double check exactly. We had a couple different versions. I mean, okay. The thing is, like, when you're doing this, you can pretty quickly, like, okay, who, name your famous Survivor players. You can get to 100 pretty quickly. Oh, yeah. you know, without breaking much of a sweat. And so I want to say we ended up at 40, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But there were, that's where we felt the hard cuts, I think, was on the iconic players, because very quickly we're like throwing out the names, and then it's like, well, we probably shouldn't just list everyone that we think is great.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard too, because it's like iconic when you're talking, you know, the people who've played four or five times, and then you're talking mm-hmm. about iconic for the new era. It's like, well, Carolyn and Jesse kind of fit there, but then there's rumors about 50.
You know? Yeah, we had to put a few new era people in. Like, we were trying to get have it be current and have representation from all of them, and not just cluster around like who appeared on Winners at War and Heroes versus Villains. You know, we wanted to spread it around a lot more beyond that.
Are you, as you're hearing the 50 news and your book's coming out and you're starting to kind of dive in and you know, you're just talking about the book and you've been talking about the book for so long, you're watching season 48. Are there people that you're really dying to see on 50 that maybe you weren't expecting that you'd really be dying to see on 50, or has it kind of stayed the same for both of you?
Kate, you want to go first?
I mean, we talk about it a lot. I feel like every time we're on the phone, we're like, oh, what about this for 50? Like, kind of just theorizing what it could be. I don't have anyone like I'm dying for. I'm just excited to see who they put on and what route they go with, because I don't really know what to expect. There's a lot of different directions you could go.
That's a good answer there. Well, then I'll ask this, and I don't want to put you on the spot, so you don't have to answer, you know, if you want to like pass on this. But is there anybody you really that could be on there that you're really like, I don't need to see them again?
Oh, I got some.
Oh, you do have some. Okay, well,
you go ahead, Kate, and then I'll share mine.
You could just rattle them off if you want.
I don't need to see Boston Rob again. He's played enough. We saw him on Traders. I am content.
That would be my first choice of I don't think I said this in the book. My very controversial Survivor hot take that I know many people will disagree with is that Boston Rob absolutely deserves to be on the Mount Rushmore of Survivor. He is great TV, but he's not actually good at playing the game of Survivor. Mm-hmm. I'm content with the number of times he has had to play Survivor myself. Now, production may not be. And so I'm just kind of like, you know, it's so hard to predict what production is going to do. Are they going to be leaning into the newer era players that haven't ever had a chance to return? Are they going to be trying to do like a true all-stars from all the history of the show to really celebrate the 50th season? We're probably the last chance you could get some of those early players to possibly come on. Or, you know, is there going to be a theme? You know, who knows what we're going to get?
So do you kind of take the same approach then, Joe, as Kate, where you're like, I'll be happy with anybody, or is there somebody that you're like, please put them on? I'm dying to see them again.
Oh, there's some new era players that I think could have some really good games. Unfortunately, it's like rumors are that some of those aren't going to be able to make the cut for this. And I mean, it may sound weird after what I just said about seeing Buster Rami enough. Like, I just would not mind seeing Saree Fields play again, but that's me.
<didn't win.
laughs> Yeah, exactly. That's me. I completely understand about it. You know, anyway, it might make sense to say if you've played more than twice, you're probably not coming back to Survivor 50 just because the pool is so large now. It also could be that, you know, producers are like, we are trying to just get the biggest names that are going to create the biggest buzz. And in that instance, we probably would see some 3, 4, 5 time players come back on. I mean, I was just gonna say, like, there's fun weird like players that played once and you're like, oh, I feel like he could have had a good game. Like, I mean, it's super recent, but just Thomas from the season, it's like, I feel like that was a missed opportunity. Like, oh, to really see him be able to cause some chaos in the game. That doesn't mean he deserves a spot on season 50, but it's one of those where it's like, I understand what casting saw in Thomas that we didn't probably get to see fully play out because of some, you know, just how the game goes.
My literal winner pick for this season. He let me down. I was so bummed. No, I love Thomas. And I think that Survivor has done a good job of like pulling those players who were pre-mergers and figuring out. You talk a lot about Kelly Wentworth in this book and how, you know, her first time around, it didn't work. And then she comes out and she plays the second time and her game in Cambodia is so amazing. She's on your iconic player list, you know? And I think for a lot of people, she might not be the best player ever, but she lands on a lot of people's favorite players ever. I mean, we see the way Lauren O'Connell goes crazy over her when she comes stepping out onto that island. And I had Lauren on the podcast during this season and Lauren still goes crazy over Kelly Wentworth. Like her whole life is still Kelly Wentworth. So it's just like, you know, they do a good job. I just hope for 50 that I don't know if we're going to get those types of players for 50, but if you look at like a 52, 54, something like that, don't forget about some of the pre-mergers that went in the new era. Cause I think there's a good pull of Jem, Annika, Thomas, you know, just those. Maddie Pomillo is a really good one. Like, I think there's a lot of good names from this new era that went early.
I agree. And I mean, it's so easy to like speculate on what a good theme is, would be. And I think a first tribal versus last tribal tribes matchup where like you went out on your first time to tribal, not you were the first boot of the season, but just the first time you had a chance to be voted out, you were voted out. That's one tribe. And the other one is finalists that didn't win the game. They were at the last, you know, they were at the last tribal. Cause I think there'd be so much drive from both those groups, like to feel like I never had a chance and I was so close. Like I think you'd get some really interesting gameplay, and there's so many fun players that would fit both those parameters.
Yeah, and Jelinski also gets a mention in this book, everybody, and that's somebody that I think a lot of people would be like, you know, please, where's Jelinski? I mean, he literally episode several, like you were talking about, it was funny to read your section and hear about the jargon, right? About, you know, like we have like, you know, these different phrases that we just say that have become so synonymous with the show that we don't even think about where it began. And here's a guy who plays the game and several means seven. And now all of a sudden several is what we say in the Survivor community. I mean, he's literally hosting a watch party this Wednesday because it's May 7th and it's May several. And he's hosting a watch party in Las Vegas this Wednesday.
And that's one of those like completely accidental moments that just becomes for the deep, you know, the fans that know, it becomes like the fandom shibboleth, like the thing you say that anyone else in the room know this. And then like, you're my people. When you understand that kind of reference.
Yeah, no, I think that would be a fun idea. I think there's some early players that, you know, maybe we won't see because they've waited too long. Mm-hmm. What do you think that there's, and this really has nothing to do with the book, but do you think that there's like a sweet spot in when the returning players should, like when the season should have any number of returning players, how many in between, anything like that?
Kate, do you have any strong opinions on this?
Wait, what do you mean a sweet spot between...
Like, so for instance, season one, we went through up until season 8 and then we finally had returning players. And then everybody says, well, we didn't have anybody else until season 16. It's like, well, actually we had 2 people return in 11. Like, and now we haven't had anybody return since season 40 and those were only winners. So we haven't had anybody be able to return since season 38. Is there like a sweet spot? Because now it feels like we've missed out on some opportunities to build some of these iconic Mount Rushmore type characters because they haven't had a chance to play again.
I feel like they're hitting right on it because it's like a momentous season. I like when it's something like big and there's a reason why
not just
they're doing like, it.
Game Changers, just season 34. Kind of like, like, well, here's Game Changers. just come out. Like I feel like there have been times where they've gone too rapid in having the returning players, whether it's a portion of the cast is returning players or the whole cast is returning players where like, okay, I didn't have enough time to to breathe between. Like, if you could find a rhythm of like the 5 and the 10, you know, like those are your returning player seasons, and the ones in between are all new players, and then where you're going to be drawing from those. I think that would make sense, because if it becomes returning players too frequently, it starts to feel too insular. Like, it's now just like it's Survivor about survival, like what we already know. And part of the fun of Survivor is these random people, you know, being thrown on an island. If we're getting to know them and they're getting to know each other. And I don't want to ever lose that and lean too far into every season has returning captains or you know, an entire returning cast.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we're probably going to see 50. And then I think we're going to see a couple returning player seasons, whether it's half the cast or full cast, mm-hmm. not long after that. Cause I think 50 will be so successful. And I do think that at this point, Jeff and everybody's probably like, we're not going to get everybody we want. Like, Carolyn confirmed on our podcast 2 weeks ago that she was cut. And it's like, if Carolyn's cut, you know, that's probably not what some of these people who are higher up wanted. It might just be kind of pushed. And I could see them saying, no, I think about after 31 with Second Chance, you know, how many of those people came back and played on Game Changers? It was almost like Game Changers was an excuse to be able to get some of those players back on.
Yeah. Yeah, I won't be surprised, because they're in communication. And I mean, that part of that doesn't need to, like, it must be hard to like know, like in casting, like I'm dealing with people's hopes and dreams. Like I am reaching out, like as soon as they see a message from me, like I know their hopes are soaring, even if I'm in the most careful way possible, just trying to say, I'm just trying to find out if you would be available. And to, you know, to be on production and to know those people with returning players where you already have a relationship with them, I would completely understand the impulse to say, okay, we got this batch for 50, but let's do another returning player season in 52. And, you know, and bring in some of the ones that didn't make the cut for 50. And also, I'm sure there'll be a ratings bump for 50. And that's something CBS is going to be it's easier marketing when it is already known players. That's one reason why we get waves of returning player seasons, is like, you know, ratings have dipped a little. CBS marketing is asking us to do something to make sure that we can bring some fans back in, and returning players seasons is one of those things.
I mean, just from the podcast perspective, our numbers for Game Changers and Winners at War are still our highest numbers by far, like by far. And it doesn't matter like how good the content might be. And then it goes though to what you were talking about, where some of these more controversial, what do people actually watch the show for? Our highest viewed episode that was a recap, that's not Winners at War, not Second Chance, not Game Changers, and not a premiere or finale, is the Zeke versus Varner episode. It is that episode. And I think it's very interesting how like returning players and massive controversial moments, that's like what people kind of come and tune into more. They want to hear the discussion about it. And I always feel like especially like with like the Zeke Varner thing, I always felt like I'm not actually able to talk about this. Like I'm the last person you should be coming to hear like talk about these types of bigger, you know, the whole, you know, system moments. Like I don't know how to talk about those properly, you know, and I don't want, like, I want to talk about Survivor, but it's fascinating that this is what people tune into. And I think there will be a ratings bump for sure on this.
Yeah. And like CBS has already said, like they're planning kind of a year long, but like once the season is over, I think we're getting a Survivor 50 push. Sorry, season 49 cast, who's out there, you know, feeling you are going to not be feeling the love when it comes to the Survivor discussion and promotion, I fear.
I mean, all anybody wants to talk about is 50. It's especially since people aren't loving season 48. It's like all they want to talk about is 50. I mean, if we put out a 50 episode tomorrow, it would get more views than whatever we put out this week about Survivor 48. And I just think that's crazy, because it's like 50's a phantom far away. Like we don't know what that's going to be yet. And even if you guys find out all the information about the cast and everything this summer, you still have to wait till next February or March to actually start watching that season. It's a while still.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting too. Like you're saying, like this season has become, you know, kind of like particularly the last episode, people have said is like one of the most boring episodes ever because you could see where it was going. But I think there's a lot of like fondness for the cast and people feel like it was good casting. It's just because one dominant alliance has been able to take control. People are like, ah, it's a boring season. And, you know, what is that magic mix that happens between a great cast and dynamic gameplay that makes it into a great season? I mean, you never know where we'd get it every season. Like Survivor's trying to make that happen every single season. Yeah. And we know it doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah. And so when you guys put your tiers together, and I guess we can kind of use this to wrap up. So Joe, if you had to pick one season as your favorite, do you have one that stands out as your common answer or no?
Yes. My favorite season is probably Heroes versus Villains. Just the gameplay from beginning to end, the great characters that are there. I think that's one of the strongest, but I have the caveat that like that wouldn't be what I recommend to someone if they want to get into Survivor, because it's the returning player season. For a newbie season, I probably would recommend Token Change, because it's in the HD era. It's got big personalities. It's got great characters. It's got fun gameplay that happens within it. So those would probably be like, if it's all new players, probably Token Change. Returning players, Heroes versus Villains. But it's hard. There's a lot of good seasons out there.
Mm-hmm. Kate, do you have one that you go as your go-to answer?
Oh, there's so many, but... yeah, Tokachins is very high up there. It's a soft spot, and it's just so good. I also really love David versus Goliath. It's just a fun, strong season. It's entertaining. Great, iconic moments. But I also really love the Blood versus Water seasons, because that's just a fascinating dynamic that they create. I don't know. There's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when you look at our 5-star seasons, like Token Cheese isn't in there, in part because like we really limited it. And it's like what my personal favorite is versus like what is like objectively the best Survivor seasons. Mm-hmm. That can be a different discussion entirely. And we tried to navigate some of those difficult choices when we were making our list. Yeah.
And I think that's the hardest thing to do when you do this, because China is my favorite season. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, so it's like, for me, I'm like, well, China's a 5-star season. I still think China still fits into the 5-star, but it's funny because then like one of my next favorite seasons is Vanuatu. People don't have Vanuatu. I saw where you have Vanuatu ranked.
The general consensus would not be Vanuatu as a 5-star season.
And it's not my second favorite season, but like Vanuatu is a top 10 season to me, because I love Chris's storyline. I think it's a fascinating dynamic throughout the season. I think the way Amy Cusack just takes the women and just dominates the entire game, all for it to just implode at Final Seven, I think is a phenomenal storyline, and I find it so satisfying. But I also know that like if I were to go on here and say that is legitimately the 5th or 6th best season in Survivor history, people would be like, you're out of your mind. You can think there's a difference between favorite and best. And I think that's like with movies, right? It's like The Godfather's the best, but that might not be my favorite. And I think that's the same thing when it comes to Survivor seasons. Yeah. And that's what makes it hard to be like, well, I would still say China for everything though, even though it's not HD, which is a problem. It HD, is. That jump is great.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like you feel it when you're like, oh, Gabon, what do we have here?
My whole screen is full now rather than just the middle. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. like we said, we're trying to be objective, but we know there's so much subjectivity in these lists, so I do not mind anyone who disagrees with our tiers or how we break up the eras. I completely understand there's gonna be a lot of opinions on that.
So closing thoughts, May 20th the book comes out. It's available for pre-order now. I have the link in the description here for everybody, but any closing thoughts, Joe, Kate, that you want to leave everybody with before we wrap this up?
I just really gained an appreciation in doing that research and going back and reading those news articles from the year 2000 about how different Survivor was than any other piece of entertainment, and how significant in the history of American popular culture Survivor really is. It's something that we lose track of because it's not the cultural phenomenon it was now. Like we're not getting the tens of millions of viewers. And there's so many other reality TV shows that like what Survivor is can feel a little diluted in terms of the, you know, just the breadth of reality TV shows that exist. But I think there's a reason Survivor is still going strong 25 seasons in, why it is one of the most significant pieces of television entertainment that's ever been produced in American culture. And it's both that cultural context of when it came out, what it was that was so different, but also just the quality of the show. Like, this is just a good show. Like there's solid entertainment to be had in Survivor across all, all of its seasons, the highs and the lows.
Yeah. Kate, any final thoughts here?
Just that it's such an important show, and there's so much commentary on it from fans, from TV critics, from former players. We're just part of the discussion. We're not like a final say. We're not declaring anything. We're just enjoying the commentary and contributing to it. And so as you read it, like, you want to message us that you disagree, we'll take it and we'll talk about it. And it's just a part of the commentary with everyone else on this amazing show.
Yeah.
We're stepping into an existing conversation that will still be going after the book is published.
Well, and that's okay. So this is I have to ask you this because I almost forgot, but every other one of these books you've written, the show's over. Mm-hmm. This one you write and this could go on. I mean, like Jeff said, you know, season 51, we're talking about 50, we're ready for 51. And then how do we get to 60? And Jeff might die before the show ends. Like the show might go after Jeff, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so is there ever a part of you, as you know, even though this was for this series and everything like that, is there ever a part of you that's going to be like, I want to touch this up, I want to do a part two? Like, have you thought about that at all, of like where you would kind of be able to fit, you know, updates into this, or is this kind of like, this is the beast and this is what it is?
I think every episode I text Joe, oh, I wish this could be in the book. Just a little moment, just a line said.
I've got three sons that are 12, 10, and 8 that have become Survivor fans, and they're watching the current season. But then when the current season ends, they ask me for an old season to watch, and I watch a lot of those episodes with them. And I'll be sitting there like, oh, we should have talked about this from that season that aired, you know, 20 years ago. Like, wish we could put that into the book. So I don't know that I'll ever be able to turn off that switch. Even talking about the old Survivor stuff, like there's so much that, you know, it's such a big franchise, and there's so much commentary that we read and listened to in terms of podcasts and YouTube videos and news articles. But then there's constantly the new stuff. So of course, I think there'll be a pool to, you know, whether it's write a full on sequel at some point down the line, or just do a second edition with, added content. Mm-hmm. I think that definitely will be something that we're going to be unable to avoid thinking about.
It'll be funny when the second edition, everybody be like, okay, it's going to be seasons 47 through whatever. And it's going to be, no, those first 50 pages are still dedicated to everything we didn't get in from seasons 1 through 2. We're ready to go back and talk about all these other massively significant moments. And that's the beauty of Survivor. I mean, I rewatch these older seasons, and like even Thailand and All Stars, which I love that you put All Stars as one star. I hate that season. And my normal co-host Will loves that season and thinks it's so entertaining because they're so bad to each other. And I'm like, no, that season's terrible. So I love that that's a one star, but like there's so much to be gained even from the bad seasons of Survivor. Mm-hmm. And there's so many like big moments that either impacted the show or just interesting to see. So I always love an excuse to go back and rewatch them. And that's why it's nice that right now my wife and I are just like rolling through the glory days, and Nicaragua is going to hit hard, but we're almost there, you know.
When we were starting the project, there was that moment of like, okay, we've all re-binged like The Office, or you know, like we did that with Frasier and Cheers. Like we re-binged those shows, but everyone kind of re-binges their favorite sitcom. But it was like, when we already know the winner, is Survivor going to be re-bingeable? Absolutely. I found for me, completely, I could go back and watch an old season and be thoroughly entertained. And that question was gone like within the first moment I started Borneo again. I'm like, oh, okay, no, this is, I could definitely rewatch all of this.
I think that Survivor, when you know who wins, I think you have the quote in there from Mike Bloom where he says, mm-hmm. I don't actually know, I can't evaluate a Survivor season until I've watched it twice. And I think that's so true, because you watch it the first time, it's like watching The Usual Suspects, right? You watch it the first time, you see the ending, and you're like, wow, how did they do that? So then you watch it a second time and you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's how they did that. That's amazing. That really was like all the seeds were there. And I think what's amazing about Survivor is you can focus your attention on different players kind of depending on the point in your life you're at, right? Like I'm married now. I've only been married for, you know, a couple years. And so my enjoyment of like, you know, who am I kind of latching onto when I start to watch the older season? I'm like, oh, there's a young married guy. Like I didn't get his story the first time or anything. But then even as you're watching that, like rewatching Token Sheens this time, I've always thought Aaron was great. And then rewatching it this time, I'm like, Aaron is so great. Why do people not talk about Aaron more? And because like you can see her story, you can see Taj's story. Mm-hmm. And even though Coach and Tyson and JT and Fishback really own that season, Sierra and Taj and Brendan and Aaron, they're so fascinating to watch. And it's like you can kind of watch every season and see it from a different person's perspective, mm-hmm. or I don't know. I think it's endlessly bingeable, especially if it's a good season. If it's like One World or Redemption Island or Nicaragua, maybe
turn on the speeder and watch that one at 2x. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Don't buy those DVD box sets, everybody. Yeah. But well, it was such a pleasure to talk to both of you. I'm so glad you all reached out. Once Upon an Island says to email him, Joe. I don't know if you see the comments here on the side, but he says to email away. So you know.
I did not see the comments. I will.
Yeah, you got a fan in there now. So thank you so much for coming in here. Again, the book comes out on May 20th. So if you're interested, the link is in the description below. And everybody, thank you so much for listening. I'll be back Wednesday night with Will, recapping episode number 11. If you haven't checked out our episode with Austin from season 45, go check that out from this past Saturday. We predict what's going to happen this week, and I'm keeping hope alive that we're going to get a blindside. So I'm not negative, Nancy. Everybody else is. All right, everybody, like the video, subscribe to the channel, and we'll see you next time.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
Are you missing the sounds that matter most? What if you could hear every word, every laugh, and every moment crystal clear without spending thousands on expensive hearing aids? Introducing Audionatum, the world's most affordable FDA-approved hearing aid. With the revolutionary A2 chip, you get premium sound, zero background noise, and a 24-hour rechargeable battery. They even have Bluetooth connectivity to connect to your cell phone or TV. Unlike those traditional bulky $5,000 prescription hearing aids, the Audionatum is 90% smaller, 20 times cheaper, and works instantly. No visits to the audiologist needed. Audionatum has over 500,000 happy customers who have trusted Audionatum to restore their hearing. Our 100% money-back guarantee means zero risk to try. Don't like them? Simply return them and get your money back. They also come with a lifetime warranty. For the next 72 hours, the Audionatum is 53% off. Go to tryhearingaid.com right now to order your pair for only $99. Again, go to tryhearingaid.com to order your pair for only $99. Order now before it's too late, as these hearing aids have sold out over 10 times this year. With Audionatum, you can hear life again.